Dottle Talks Tech, episode number 32, Indiana Jones and the Raiders Guys. Dottle.
It's Dottle Talks Tech with James DeRuvo.
Never touch another man's butt.
Online at dottlenews.com.
Well, have you ever watched a movie and said, I could do that, and taking it really literally, then you're going to enjoy our next guest. Chris Strompolis is part of a two-man crew known as the Raiders Guys, and they started when they were just 12 and 11, respectively, with his partner, Eric Zala, and they made a shot-for-shot remake of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and they even got to show it to Steven Spielberg. Chris, thank you for joining us on Dottle Talks Technology.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So, you're obviously not 12 now.
No, certainly not.
This has been a lifelong project for you.
It has. It's been a lifelong endeavor. And, of course, with the addition of the plane scene, just recently, yeah, this project spans well over three decades.
So according to your bio, in 1982, in Ocean Springs, Mississippi, you asked your partner, Eric, a simple question. Would you like to help me remake Raiders of the Lost Ark? Why did you want to do that?
Well, for a lot of us who grew up during that time, Raiders of the Lost Ark was a new level of cinematic inspiration. And, of course, Indiana Jones, that hero, was, you know, something that was new to a lot of us. And I think that, you know, migrating over from the whole Star Wars mythology and our love and fascination with Han Solo, Harrison Ford, you know, ported over his charisma and machismo so perfectly into the Indiana Jones character. He's just like a perfect movie hero. And he did a lot of cool things, and everything was in camera and practical, and it felt like a real world. And I, as a 10-year-old boy, you know, when I saw the film, I thought, God, how cool would it be able to do that? You know, I wonder what it feels like to drag behind a truck and be in a room full of snakes and save the girl and fight the bad guys and go underneath a moving truck and light stuff on fire, you know,
and your garage
and our, yeah. And now, and run from a boulder. And now I know.
So you were able to film on a submarine, mm-hmm. and ultimately you did the did a Kickstarter campaign to finish the film with the infamous fist fight at the airplane scene. Mm-hmm. But I think probably the hardest thing that you had to try and pull off was casting a 15-year-old as your love interest when you're 12.
Yeah, well, that was Eric's doing. We had an initial Marion Ravenwood, her name was Stephanie Ewing, and we shot a bunch of stuff with her, and then we came back the next summer, and she had moved away without telling us, so we had to recast and reshoot everything. And that's when Angela, Eric met Angela and knew Angela from church, and met her and asked her if she wanted to be our lead in our movie, and she said yes.
So walk us through the process of doing a shot for shot remake from the point of view of a 12-year-old learning filmmaking as he goes.
Well, it was a pretty organic
Did you
approach.
Start at the very, very beginning of the film and just because you didn't know any better and just shot every single film, or did you read a behind-the-scenes book, or what did you do to get ready?
We had collected a lot of memorabilia, and, you know, things were in magazines, and, you know, we didn't see the movie as much as you would think. We worked from memory for the first 3 years, and
VHS hadn't really hit yet.
It was Betamax.
Yeah.
So we cobbled together as much as we could, and then Eric sat down and storyboarded one summer well over 600 individual storyboards, and we used that as our shooting Bible, and we shot stuff over and over again, and we experimented with lighting and experimented with angles, and And, you know, we had camera problems and all sorts of issues, and we just kept shooting and shooting and reshooting and reshooting. And we didn't shoot in order. We shot out of order.
I take it you shot on Super 8 back then?
No, we shot on Betamax.
Ah, so one of those very first cameras.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember one of my friends had his dad had one of those old VHS tapes where cameras where the camera was separate from the recorder and you had to carry this big heavy 25-pound recorder on your shoulder.
Yeah, or a side pack. You know, we shot with side packs and we shot with 3/4-inch cameras too. And then we burned out our Betamax camera, ended up shooting with a VHS camera later on.
Okay, so did you think starting off that you were going to be able to do the whole thing?
Well, I think we had intended to do the whole thing. We just didn't necessarily know how long it was going to take us. We thought we'd be able to do it in a summer, and it ended up taking us 7 summers.
How much of the film did you get done?
Well, pretty much nothing. I mean, the first 2 years were spent pre-production, and we had shot some stuff, but it was pretty much unusable. I mean, I think it was unwatchable. It was so bad. I think it was not really until the third year that we started really getting footage that we cared about and that was worth keeping.
I have to say that growing up, you must suffer from Dick Clark's disease, because from going from 12 and then finishing up at 19 and then for shooting for 7 years, I get you did such a good job that it really didn't stand out that you were aging as the process went.
Well, thanks. Yeah, the footage that you see in the finished movie, you know, aside from the plane scene now, really spans, I think my youngest moment, I was 13, and then my oldest moment was 17. So there's only really a 4-year difference. I mean, I'm still kind of baby-faced in some scenes. I mean, of course, the costume and the hat help.
Yes.
Because it's so sort of iconic. But yeah, there's definitely a notable difference in coming out of the Well of the Souls and seeing the flying wing, jumping from age 16 to 43. There's a little bit of a jump there.
A little bit. Yeah, but by then you're just so into the movie. You hardly notice it. Unless that's what you're looking for. And that really is a testament to the story itself. I mean,
for sure.
The Kasdan story is just is fantastic. And I mean, the script. And so putting together, now there are some really challenging things that you put together in the film. You had to build the arc. You had to ultimately shoot on a transport ship, but also a submarine.
Mm-hmm.
You had to shoot in a submarine pen.
Mm-hmm.
And so walk us through the process of collecting those assets and being a teenage kid and trying to get use of those assets for a film that's already been made.
It's just, the general rule and a nice lesson that we learned when we were kids is, and it's something that has carried well into our adult lives, is that, and it's advice that we actually share with young filmmakers too, and filmmakers that want to do anything that seems kind of impossible, but it's, you'd be surprised what you could get if you just ask for it, you know? And how does a 13-year-old kid get a submarine? You know, well, you ask for it and see what you can do to get it. And it took me 3 years of asking for that submarine, but we finally got it. And that was just our sort of principle that Eric and I have always sort of had, is that we just keep asking and keep laboring, and we are unwavering in our requests. And it's sometimes, we just wear the situation down until we get what we want. So,
so obviously you where how far away from home did you have to travel for that?
Not too bad. It was one of the few places where we shot out of state It was maybe a 50-minute drive into – it was – we were in Mississippi. We just drove to Mobile, Alabama to the Back Bay to a the Naval Park there and work with the U.S. Navy has a retired vessel park there.
Okay, and I just assumed that until you got a yes on the hard, difficult things, you proceeded to do other shots.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we shot as much as we could along the way, depending on what was ready and what we could. You know, so if, like, the boulder was ready, we'd shoot that. If the truck was ready, we'd shoot that. If the college scenes were all ready to go, we would do that. If the map room was ready, we would work on that. We'd shoot a scene here. We'd shoot a scene here. You know, we would do what we could to maintain progress.
Walk me through the arc room and that the whole sequence of events in shooting from the map room to the arc room with all the snakes and building the gigantic towering. Walk me through that from the perspective of, you know, I'm thinking from the perspective of a father. You must have one of the most supportive parents in the world.
I try to be, you know, I mean, she's seven and she's got her own interests.
No, I'm talking about your parents.
Oh, yeah. Well, Eric and I were raised, you know, our parents were supportive. We were primarily raised by single mothers. So our moms were, you know, super, super supportive. All the scenes were shot in Eric's mom's house. So the Well of the Souls was shot there. The map room was shot there. The bar scene. All the cave stuff, Imam's house, the Arab bar, the melting scene, you know, all those interiors were shot in sort of, you know, what became the Raiders soundstage in Ocean Springs, and including all the fire shots. And so everything was built under the house in the sprawling basement that we turned into our Elstree Studios, essentially.
You built the arc basically from did you just build that basically from memory?
Eric, I mean, we obviously there was a lot of pictures of it. So Eric, you know, Eric was wanting to be a comic book artist. So his ability to draw and sketch and capture details and dimensions and things like that were much more refined than mine. And so Eric is extremely precise. I'm fairly precise, but I'm a, you know, I get frustrated and cut corners, you know, and Eric, so Eric was the one who took point on building the arc, and between looking at all the dimensions and trying to emulate the original prop, he also went and referenced, you know, biblical dimensions as well, and basically bought plywood and styrofoam and gold spray paint and construct it accordingly.
Where's that arc now? Is it in a warehouse?
No, yeah. the arc is actually still at Eric's mom's house. Eric's mom just turned 80 and celebrated her birthday. And we all stayed there during the flying wing scene, shooting there with cast and crew just recently. So it's a historical home. It's called Many Oaks. And Raiders props and memorabilia, including the boulder, are all still there 30 years later.
Wow, the boulder is even there. Mm-hmm. Okay, so getting into the Wayback Machine and moving forward, we're in the 90s now. It really, the news of this actually happened in the 90s or the late 2000s, and Steven Spielberg hears about it. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that. I assume that at this point, only friends and family had seen it.
Well, yeah, friends and family saw it in 89, and then we shelved it for many years. And then, like, you know, umpteen years later, it was discovered by a filmmaker, Eli Roth, who had a copy of it through Six Degrees of Separation. And when his film got discovered in 2002, I think it was, he had an old beaten VHS copy, and he passed it on to the head of production at DreamWorks, who passed it on to Spielberg, who watched it and contacted Eli to contact us. And then about a year later, after the Vanity Fair piece came out, we we were able to meet Spielberg, and he asked us to come by his office, and we met with him, and it was a dream come true. He's a very nice man. It was everything that we had hoped it would be.
But the film wasn't finished.
Well, it was missing that one scene. It was missing the flying wing scene. So yeah.
And so you went to, and so now we're in 2012, somewhere around there, 2014, and you guys just want to finish the film so you can say, all right, we can move on with our lives. By now, you're married and have children.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have careers. Are either of you in the industry?
Yeah, I mean, Eric and I started our own production company called Rolling Boulder Films, and we're developing a slate of projects under that banner. And it was actually, the idea had been circulating for many years to go back and do the plane scene, but it was always sort of a joke, you know. And it wasn't until 2013, when I was on a book tour, I was in Utah, and I met Jeremy Kuhn, who's the producer of Napoleon Dynamite. And Jeremy and I hit it off rather well, and he optioned our book and optioned our story to turn it into a documentary and a narrative feature. And I had the idea of, hey, why not, as sort of a cornerstone, you know, sort of a driving set piece of the documentary, go back and show us as adults trying to pull off the airplane scene. And that resonated, and Eric got on board, and, you know, we spent the next year basically producing the scene with a Kickstarter campaign. And it was a very stressful, energetic time, you know, where we were. It was very intense. It was one of the most intense experiences I think I've ever had.
And so, and so then you decide, you went to Kickstarter, and you raised quite a chunk of change. You originally wanted to raise $50,000, and you got almost 60.
Yeah, I mean, our stretch goal was 125, which, you know, but we raised almost 60. A percentage of that goes back to Amazon and Kickstarter. Of course, we had some obligations to pay out. So, you know, when all was said and done, we really had about 42,000 to work with. And a substantial percentage of that went into simply building the airplane. And it was finding location and finding a place to build this sprawling set. And of course, you know, the airplane blows up at the end, and we needed a place where we could blow up an airplane, and we needed somebody to blow up an airplane. So there was a lot of sponsorships, a lot of volunteer work. We stretched every dollar where we could. We asked and asked and asked, and went back to our old model of, you know, well, how does a kid get a submarine? Well, you ask for it. And people pitched in, and the amount of energy and the volunteer effort was extraordinary, and we finished it. So it's currently in post-production right now.
And so people can actually see the film if they donate, or was that only a Kickstarter reward?
That was a Kickstarter reward, but it carried over to our website, and we've been able to capture, because we're still not done. And the plane scene itself was so brutal to shoot, because of weather and setbacks and all sorts of things we had. It was a very, very challenging shoot. And so we went over budget. And so we are trying to find our last sponsor to complete our campaign and create our DVDs and finish post-production on the scene itself. And so we still kind of keep that portal open on our website, so that if people want to watch it, you know, they can, you know, pledge to the project, and those monies go right into finishing the plane scene.
So you're almost there.
Mm-hmm.
You're within the sight of the in the sight of the stadium, as they say, as marathon runners say.
Yes.
And so, looking back over 30, I'm fond of telling my son who's just starting into video production now, I'm fond of saying, if I'd have had just three things, my life would be completely different. If I'd have had a computer, a video camera, and the internet, my life would be, you know, my filmmaking career would have been a heck of a lot easier.
Sure, sure. I mean, it's interesting to reflect back on that time, you know, when technology was just home-based technology was sort of burgeoning, right? You know, with home cameras and certainly the internet didn't exist. I mean, you had the big hulking Apple II Apple computers and the old IBMs with floppy drives and things like that. Even though that, you know, kids now, they have a laptop and they have the internet and they have software tools and affordable, you know, prosumer or consumer level cameras, there's still, you know, those are just tools. You know, there's still, you still need to go out there and tell a good story and put people in front of the camera and schedule things and build stuff. And, you know, so it's, I mean, I think back that, you know, even if we did have all those tools, would it have been easier? Maybe, you know, I mean, in terms of connectivity and getting things done. But, you know, I've seen technology sort of double over on itself. And a lot of filmmakers, young filmmakers, rely on technology too much to fill in the gaps of where they should be working harder or telling a better story. And even the studios do that, you know, all the way up the ladder with $100 million tentpole films where you have a lot of spectacle, but you don't have a lot of story and you don't have anything that resonates. Raiders is something that resonates.
That's kind of the way I felt about the last Hobbit film. You know, it was essentially two scenes and there was really very little in the way of story. It was just a lot of fighting.
Yeah.
And I love Tolkien as much as the next guy, but I was kind of bored.
Sure.
And I was kind of bored by it.
Yeah, a lot of people were. I haven't seen the last installment. I saw Smaug, and I felt it kind of heading in that direction.
I basically call the film "Kill the Dragon, Let's Go to War."
Yeah,
that's pretty much it.
That sounds like most people's assessment of it. You know, I mean, it's kind of a big spectacled popcorn movie that's sort of like, it's like eating a bunch of cotton candy and not really remembering that you ate it and not really remembering anything about it, but you are still sort of high from the sugar and your mind is blank and it's just sort of this like, you know, saccharine sweet experience that really has no foundation. You know?
So 30 years later, and you're almost finished with this epic tale, mm-hmm. Looking back, what are some of the lessons that you learned? And if your child came to you and said, "Dad, I want to do a shot-for-shot remake of a movie," what would you tell them?
Well, I'd say, you know, there's a few things I tell young filmmakers, which is always believe in yourself. Don't let people tell you that you can't do something. And no matter what, and no matter how uncomfortable it is, and no matter how bleak it looks, you have to finish. No matter what you start, you have to finish it. Even if you don't see any end in sight, even if it is uncomfortable for you, you have to finish it and realize that the creative process and collaboration is not always a comfortable experience. In fact, most of the time it is uncomfortable. And that is sometimes, most of the times actually, how you get your best result. And you have to slog through those difficulties to get to the blissful light on the other end of the other edge of the canyon, so to speak. And so, you know, those are some of the basic principles that I've learned.
Raiders of the Lost Ark is kind of a metaphor for for making Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Pretty much. Yeah, pretty much. It's the adventure that, you know, Indy just doesn't give up. You know, he continues and continues and continues until he gets what he wants. And, you know.
So what's next?
Well, Eric and I are working on a handful of projects. I mean, we're trying to finish up the plane scene and wrap up our Kickstarter campaign. We're looking for, you know, sort of an angel sponsor to come in and help us wrap it up. So we're seeking those funds right now to help us cross the finish line.
And when you're done with this, now, obviously you can't sell it on DVD.
Correct.
Or actually go out and put it in a movie theater and get box office receipts from it. So mm-hmm. What do you do with it?
Knowing that, have taken our film and we've actually raised money with it for charities. And so we use it as an educational tool. So we tour with it. We lecture on film. We visit schools, we visit universities, we go to film festivals and do, you know, we speak to young filmmakers and children's film festivals, and we raise money for film education and other charities through the screening of the film. So we've used it in a charitable context, and some of the charities that we've raised money for can be seen on our website and under charities. And so those are some of the folks that we've raised the money for, everything from film education to certain foundations, to AIDS research, tsunami relief, you know, all those sorts of things. So we've tried to give back and go that direction. And, you know, it opens up doors for us and sets the stage to present new projects.
And the and there's you mentioned that there's a film that's being made on your life story.
Yes, the documentary is finished. It's being edited right now. It's being refined for either a South by Southwest entry or Sundance next year. But it's basically our life story growing up inside of Raiders of the Lost Ark and shooting the flying wing scene and how Raiders has sort of impacted our life. And then the narrative feature is in the works too.
So where can people find out more information on how to help donate to finish the Shot for Shot remake?
Just go to our website, www.raidersguys.com. We have collectibles. We have books, T-shirts, rewards, things that we're creating, the finished flying wing scene, DVDs. All of these rewards are available to help us cross the finish line. If somebody has deeper pockets, there are collectible items that we have from our Raiders adventures that, you know, of course, when the doc comes out and the movie comes out, they'll be, you know, and even now they're of substantial value. Things like my original jacket that I wore for all 7 or 8 years while we were shooting, my whip, the ARC prop, you know, there's bigger collectible items with larger price tags, you know, that the people can, you know, we will ship them right to their house and you can have a piece of Raiders adaptation memorabilia, and that will help us immensely finish the project.
Well, what an adventure. My guest has been Chris Strompolis, mm-hmm. who, along with his partner Eric Zala, did a shot-by-shot remake of Raiders of the Lost Ark. You can find out more information at RaidersGuys.com. Chris, thank you for joining us on Donald Talks Technology.
Thanks so much for having me on today.
You've been listening to Donald Talks Technology. For more information, visit our website at www.news.dottleme.com. Got a question or comment? You can drop me a line at james@dottleme.com. You can like us on Facebook and also subscribe and leave us feedback on iTunes. Dottle Talks Technology is a copyrighted podcast from Dottle News. Thanks for listening. You can drop me a line at james@doddleme.com. You can like us on Facebook and also subscribe and leave us feedback on iTunes. Doddle Talks Technology is a copyrighted podcast from Doddle News. Thanks for listening.